This is called Heaven for Stanley. For his birthday, I gave Stanley a hyacinth bean, an annual, so he wouldn't have to wait for the flowers. He said, "Mark, I have just the place for it." As if he'd spent 98 years anticipating the arrival of this particular vine. I thought poetry a brace against time, the hours held up for study in a voice's cool saline. But his allegiance is not to permanent forms. His garden's all furious change, budding and rot, and then the coming up again. Why prefer any single part of the round? I don't know that he'd change a word of it. I think he could be forever pleased to participate in motion. Something opens. He writes it down. Heaven steadies and concentrates near the lavender. He's already there.
That was Mark Doty reading Heaven for Stanley from his new book, School of the Arts. For more information about Mark Doty, go to the Leonard Lopate Show page at WNYC.org. Disney Wars by James B. Stewart is the kind of a book that will appeal to lovers of Shakespeare's Macbeth and readers of People magazine alike. It's a story of civil war in the Magic Kingdom. Prince Machiavelli meets Mickey Mouse. Oh, gosh. It's full of larger-than-life characters, Michael Eisner, Jeffrey Katzenberg, Michael Ovitz, and mortal corporate combats, intimate betrayals, and blazing feuds. The book is published by Simon & Schuster, and it is my great pleasure to welcome James Stewart back to the Leonard Lopate Show. And I don't know how Mickey House? Anyway, were you lucky with this one? Events seemed to break around you.
Well, that's true. I certainly didn't expect it. I was immersed in the reporting of this. Disney had invited me out, was cooperating to a certain extent, and I was in and around the premises when Roy Disney, Walt Disney's nephew, abruptly quit the board, quit his position as chairman of animation, and declared war on Eisner. So I guess, yeah, it was luck to some extent, although I like to tell my journalism students that if you want to get hit by lightning, you've got to go walk around in the rain.
Still, you have to wonder why Disney invited you to do this. Was Michael Eisner so naive that he didn't realize giving you access to the Disney Corporation would result in a book like this?
Well, I can't speak for them on this, although I'm frequently in the position of trying to persuade people to cooperate to one degree or another. And I honestly try to tell them that I think it's generally in someone's interest that in this case, this book might have been worse. I know some people find that hard to believe, but
impossible.
I think it could have been much worse had they not shown the more human side of Eisner in the company. And, of course, I'm sure they didn't expect that events would unfold as they did. In fact, the PR people there and others were pretty honest that once Roy had quit, they acknowledged, well, we would have cooperated with you had we known this was going to happen. Although what's odd about it to me is that, to a large extent, they set these events in motion. Roy didn't just quit out of the blue on his own initiative. He was being forced off the board when he quit. They knew there was a reporter hanging around, and yet they went ahead and did that anyway.
You've written about Wall Street and about Washington. Did they prepare you for Hollywood?
Seems
like it's even a worse nest of vipers.
It's kind of, I have to say that Hollywood kind of combines the worst of the two, the greed and the money-driven culture of Wall Street with the dishonesty of Washington kind of all rolled into one, which, in all honesty, I didn't expect. I mean, I knew this wasn't the fairy tale land of the Disney cartoons, but I didn't really expect the level of treachery that I encountered.
Also, a lot of secrecy in Hollywood. It's famous for people not telling much. Were they more willing to talk as Michael Eisner's star began to wane?
Definitely. I think that is true. Michael Eisner himself at one point mentioned to me that he never wanted to name a successor because he never wanted to be a lame duck. He's like, you know, the minute they know you have a successor, you're out. And he, in almost amusing ways, ruminates from time to time about how you can't get restaurant reservations, et cetera, if you've lost your power. But it was true to some extent. I mean, certainly...
Not Michael Eisner. He would have gotten a restaurant.
I think he'll always get a restaurant table. He certainly is getting them now. But during the time I was out there, he did announce his resignation, in part because of the events that I chronicle in the story. And at that moment, I did see a remarkable turn and a remarkable willingness of people to suddenly start telling stories that hadn't been talking before.
Now, you had actually met him in a previous lifetime, hadn't you?
Yes, oddly enough. Going back many years, I went to law school and worked as a lawyer at a big firm in New York City, and I was assigned to an antitrust case involving the networks and the Hollywood studios. And my little part of the case was Paramount, and at that time, Barry Diller was the chairman, and Michael Eisner was the president of Paramount, and I had to take a deposition of his out in Hollywood. And what I most remember about it, which I actually thought was quite refreshing and charming, is that he came to the deposition. All of us lawyers from New York were, you know, dressed up in suits and ties. This was long before Casual Fridays. And he came into the office in a short-sleeved shirt and his stocking feet, which he proceeded to prop up on his coffee table. That made quite an impression on me.
This is the age of the seven habits of highly successful people, isn't it? The win-win paradigm, I do better if you do better. Michael Eisner seemed to embrace a very different kind of corporate ethic.
To put it mildly, one of his executives, after a rather amusing, at least to me amusing, conference where a sort of corporate counselor had appeared to assess whether they were a team or not, said after extensive interviews and research, he said, you know, look, you guys are so bad, you're not a team, you're not even a group. And one of the executives said, no, wait a minute, I thought three people in a room were a group. And he said, no, you are so hostile, you're so untrusting of each other, you're so competitive, you're not a group. And then later they were sitting around talking about it, and they said, yeah, well, Michael's style really is to put seven pit bulls in a pen together and see which one of them survives.
And yet they also insist that people experience the Disney thing. You dressed up as Goofy at one point.
That's correct.
To understand what was that about. Do you get to pick that?
Well, Goofy kind of picked me because I'm tall. I'm about 6'3 or 6'4, and the only major character that accommodates that level, that height, is Goofy. And the reason I wanted to do it is I had heard, and I think it's true, that every top Disney executive does go through the training and play a character in the theme parks.
Was Eisner Mickey?
Well, I assumed Eisner was Goofy as well because he's 6'4". He's as tall as I am, if maybe a little bit taller. But, you know, it's a funny thing that you asked that because I've been wondering about this. In writing the manuscript, I mentioned the Goofy thing and that other executives did this. And I inserted in there that Eisner must have been Goofy because of his height. And when I was fact-checking this, going over it with the Disney people, they insisted that I delete that reference and take it out. So I've been wondering whether Eisner did it. I mean, yeah. I can't imagine that he was anything else, but that's a little mystery.
Well, maybe he doesn't want to be associated with Goofy because he has such a huge ego.
Well, you know, that may be. Although, to be honest, I was proud to be Goofy. He's considered one of the big five, along with Mickey, Minnie, Pluto, and Donald. And when I was Goofy, I was amazed. I stepped into the park, and I was besieged with kids and even adults for whom I was a pretty big celebrity.
Now, you mentioned Eisner had been at Paramount and had great success there. Why did he leave?
Well, he didn't leave of his own volition, and I think it's critical to understanding his subsequent managerial style, if you can call it that, to understand what happened there. He was phenomenally successful there with Barry Diller, but the more successful he became, the more mistrustful the chairman of Paramount's owner, which was then Gulf and Western, Martin Davis, the more distrustful he became of him, and the less secure, ironically, Eisner's position was. I think Eisner at that point had not experienced, even in Hollywood, the sort of perverse phenomenon where the more successful someone is, the more threatening they become to their boss.
And then he did the same thing when he took over.
It's kind of like, I guess, I don't want to stretch the analogy, but you know, children who are abused as children often turn around and abuse their parents. That having been the victim of what was obviously a gross injustice in terms of his being fired from Paramount, he turned around and dispatched everybody who seemed to really thrive under him, starting with his very, very close colleague, Jeffrey Katzenberg.
We'll get to that in a moment. I wonder whether he was even the right man for Disney. But Disney was in pretty bad shape, wasn't it?
Disney was in very bad shape. Ironically, given the story, it was Roy Disney, who was then on the board, who quit the board back then, and in fact helped to bring Eisner into the company because he thought it needed new blood. But to a degree that I also found somewhat amusing, that Disney of 1984 was locked in, or kind of, you know, glazed in amber from the years of Walt himself. And the current management was so hidebound that they had essentially stopped making pictures.
But it's interesting that when people come here to interview as temps or as interns, they tend to have exhaustively researched the place, not to mention listening to public radio for many years. Eisner, in a draft of his autobiography, said that he knew absolutely nothing about Disney.
Wouldn't he
have prepared himself? And wouldn't they have wanted him to know a bit about the company?
Well, you would have thought so, but whether they just took it for granted that everyone of his age has been exposed to the Disney classics, or they decided it didn't matter, I don't know, but no one ever asked him. And he said it was lucky for him because, as you say, he had never been taken to the Disney animated films as a child.
But he was also coming in as an outsider in a new wave of outsiders. Disney had always been a rather closed shop until then. Mm-hmm. I guess their hope was that new blood would shake the company up. And it wasn't just Eisner, Jeffrey Katzenbach, you mentioned Katzenberg. And Frank Wells. They all came at the same time.
Yeah, I think it's also very important to understand the story that Eisner did not take over Disney alone, that he came in as a team with Frank Wells, who had much more managerial operating experience, was a lawyer, and the prodigiously hardworking and creative Jeffrey Katzenberg, who had played such a big role in the success at Paramount. So right from the beginning, there was a trio sort of running the new operation, and there was someone, particularly Frank Wells, who could act as a check on some of Eisner's impulses that were maybe not such great ideas. He's the kind of person, and I've known several, who, you know, spew ideas all the time, and maybe two or three out of ten are really brilliant, and the other seven do need to be stopped.
But he had worked with Eisner at Paramount, so they knew they could work together.
Yes, they worked together very well. Of course, Katzenberg, the evolution of that relationship is quite interesting because Katzenberg was the junior member of the team. I'm fascinated by the use of the word partner in Hollywood. It's flung around a great deal, but it doesn't seem to have its common meaning. But they were partners of a sort in Hollywood. But Katzenberg was always deferential. He was the junior partner. And I think much to his irritation, even deep into their tenure together, Eisner referred to Katzenberg as his, quote, golden retriever, unquote, which, of course, was somewhat patronizing. So as Katzenberg became more and more successful, and I found quite interesting, he really single-handedly almost created what became the Lion King phenomenon based on his own coming-of-age experiences. And as he grew in stature, and as the nature of this partnership naturally began to become a little bit more equal, this created immense stress for Eisner.
Because Katzenberg actually turned around the animation department. After 4 years as the head of Disney, Eisner received a compensation of $40 million, and Katzenberg received no bonus at all. How did anybody justify that disparity?
Well, it was justified because, astoundingly, when he came there, Jeffrey Katzenberg was given a bonus formula that said he was entitled to 2% of the profits from every idea that he generated. In profits in the broadest sense, meaning merchandising, you know, videos, whatever came out of it, in perpetuity. Now, Eisner and Wells, it was really Wells who came up with this idea, thought that this was very clever because there never would be any profits on these things by the time you go through the Hollywood accounting process. They had no idea that the animation hits he put into effect, like Beauty and the Beast, Little Mermaid, The Lion King, would turn out to be these multi-billion dollar properties. So although he didn't get an annual bonus the way Eisner did, when it came time for him to leave, when he was effectively pushed out by Eisner, he said, well, okay, I'm here to collect my 2%. And this is what's really astounding, because then Eisner said, I'm sorry, you know, you don't get anything. You don't get your 2%. You forfeited the 2%. And Jeffrey Katzenberg came in and slapped the contract down on Eisner's desk and said, look, my 11-year-old twins could read this and tell you that I'm entitled to my 2% bonus. And that became a very famous litigation. Eisner, displaying the stubbornness for which he has become infamous, dug in his heels, wouldn't pay him, and ultimately Disney had to pay out $280 million to settle this claim.
My guest is James B. Stewart, author of Heart of a Soldier, the best-selling Blind Eye and Bloodsport, the blockbuster Den of Thieves. His latest is called Disney War, and it is published by Simon & Schuster, and we will continue right after this.
WNYC is supported by the Valley Hospital Center for In Vitro Fertilization in Paramus, New Jersey, specializing in vitro fertilization and reproductive surgery. More at 201-291-6400. The Valley Hospital, doctors and technology at their best. WNYC is a media sponsor of Central Park Summer Stage, presented by Snapple, featuring performances of American and world music, dance, and spoken word, now through August 18th. Complete schedule at summerstage.org.
This year, the leaders of the Sudanese People's Liberation Army and the government in Khartoum, Sudan, signed a peace deal to end that country's civil war. In the coming months, millions of Sudanese who fled the fighting are expected to return to South Sudan.
On the outskirts of Rumbek, shoulder-high huts of palm fronds and bamboo are clustered in a dusty clearing. These are the temporary homes of returnees.
Tuned into the world. Morning Edition, every morning on WNYC.
We're back with James B. Stewart, whose latest book is called Disney War. It is published by Simon & Schuster. And this has been the subject of many newspaper articles. You would have thought that people would have been aware of most of this because these people have been very out in the open about this war. Why do you think you have so much new material here?
Well, I think in many cases I was the first outsider, the first reporter to get people to speak candidly about what had really happened, as opposed to the sort of posturing that has gone on in these very public lawsuits. Partly because a lot of this was a subject of litigation. There were these armies of lawyers around everything who told everyone not to talk except in court. So you only got this sort of like ritualized disclosure of information. And in fact, the sort of the story behind all of that was in many cases essential to understand why it had happened, and also much more interesting than the kind of the legally relevant facts that came out in court. And then in the case of Roy Disney and his close ally Stanley Gold, they declared war and left the board while I was doing the reporting on this, and so no one had really ever had access to board members. And this really was lucky that because they were willing to talk about board meetings, they opened up a world of corporate governance that I think typically we reporters never get access to.
How much of this is just a matter of class consciousness? Eisner went to better schools than Katzenberg. Katzenberg has a kind of a rough side, doesn't he?
That is true. Although Eisner grew up in a very wealthy and upper class family in New York. Katzenberg also grew up in a wealthy family in New York, although one that was more, I think, much more recently wealthy, and he did not finish college. And Eisner is very, I don't know if snobbish is the right word, but sort of an elitist about these things, maybe because he came from a family where the males had all gone to Princeton, and then he didn't go to Princeton. There's some mystery about whether he ever applied and didn't get in. In any event, he still went to a good school, a liberal arts college, Denison University, but it wasn't Princeton. And so he's very conscious of where people go to school. And he did repeatedly ridicule Katzenberg for his failure to have an education and for a few of the malapropisms that Katzenberg would occasionally emit.
Well, it also had been a very WASPy company, and now suddenly we have all these Jewish guys coming in and changing the tone, although you get the feeling that Eisner really bought into the old spirit. He insisted on hosting The Wonderful World of Disney on television, didn't he?
Yes, he did, against everybody's advice. I mean, he did at one point approach Roy Disney, who looks a lot like his Uncle Walt.
And why wasn't Disney, Roy Disney, taking over at this time?
Roy is by nature a relatively shy, somewhat modest person, although I think that demeanor masks a very, very strong determination and, in fact, a fierce devotion to the Disney image and the Disney name. But he didn't feel that he would be a particularly good host. So he turned it down, and at that point, Eisner clearly decided that he would be the one to do it, and they rejected all kinds of promising stars. And finally, when Roy actually saw the screen test of Eisner, which everyone unanimously agreed was terrible, Roy began to have second thoughts, thinking he'd made a mistake because Eisner was so awkward and stiff. And although I must say he's gotten much better over the years, at least the recent ones I've seen, he's still awkward and stiff in that role. But Katzenberg in particular put his finger on it, I think, when he realized that Eisner fiercely wanted to claim the mantle of Walt Disney. He wanted the respect, the even adulation that Walt Disney had received as a creative genius, and that was one way of stepping into that role.
Is that why he made such a commitment to the theme parks?
I think so, although I think his imagination was truly fired by that. I mean, and I do feel he deserves credit. I mean, he elevated the architectural standards, certainly of many of the buildings, the hotels around Disney World. He kept the Imagineering unit going when many said that it wasn't cost effective. And unfortunately, he grossly overspent in the building of Euro Disney, now called Disneyland Paris, to the degree where it's possible that that will never make any money or even fall into bankruptcy.
And now there is another problem with another area that they went into. Eisner and Katzenberg made a deal started making adult films as well as the animated films, and then they actually made the deal with Miramax, which has fallen apart.
Yes, although, again, I hasten to say that by adult films, we mean like, you know, PG,
yes.
Or, you know, grown-up films.
Films for people who just don't go to see
right.
cartoons.
And the Miramax deal was a Katzenberg idea in its entirety, and it was a really brilliant idea to broaden the reach, to attach Disney to some, you know, incredible creative forces. Now, there's no question that the Weinstein brothers, who are behind Miramax, are difficult personalities, and it would certainly take a skillful management, but that was something that Katzenberg had with them. They had an excellent relationship. They generated a massive number of Academy Awards and an incredible stream of revenue. Only at this point, I mean, the test of wills, once Katzenberg was gone, it was only a matter of time between the egos of Eisner and what he considered his underlings. The Weinsteins were going to clash to a fatal degree, and indeed they did.
Is that what happened with the Pixar deal as well? Pixar Yes. really meant an awful lot of money to Disney.
Oh, it's I disclosed in the book something that I found astounding, which was internal analyses, which showed what an incredibly high percentage of the total studio profits were traceable to the Pixar films in which Disney gets a 50% split. And Miramax was completely owned by Disney. So you could argue, although I think it didn't show good judgment, but you could argue that, yes, the Weinsteins were subservient to Eisner, and he could boss them around if he wanted to. But Steve Jobs at Pixar was a quote-unquote partner, and he, I think, took umbrage at Eisner's attempts to do the same with him.
What about Michael Ovitz? Ovitz was brought in, and you would have thought that would have worked out. These are two guys who kind of, they'd been friends for years, hadn't they?
Well, they were supposedly best friends. They had been friends for 25 years, and they were supposedly best friends. After Katzenberg was gone, and after Frank Wells, the then president and COO, was tragically killed in a helicopter accident, Eisner resisted naming another president. He took on the titles of chairman, CEO, and president, which I think was a clue to what was really going on here. But nevertheless, after he himself had a near-fatal heart attack, he finally agreed to hire a president, and he tapped his best friend, Michael Ovitz, who had been dubbed by the Wall Street Journal the most powerful man in Hollywood. Well, guess who was the most powerful man in Hollywood? Even before Ovitz got there, Eisner had pulled the rug out from under him. He created an impossible set of circumstances for him to succeed in. And after 16 tumultuous, disastrous, conflict-ridden months in which the friendship was destroyed, Ovitz was fired and had to be paid a package worth $140 million.
Now, why do you think that happened? Ovitz was supposed to bring a lot of high-profile people to the Disney Corporation. He represented some of the most famous stars in music and in film, and he probably would have done very well by Disney. Was Eisner a self-destructive person here?
Well, Ovitz brought a series of highly visible, splashy deals to Disney. For example, he was put in charge of the Hollywood Record Division, which was floundering, and he brought a deal to sign Janet Jackson, who was then the most powerful, popular artist in the country. Eisner summarily vetoed it. Every idea that that Ovitz brought, Eisner vetoed. Now, some of these maybe were not such great ideas, but some of them were later implemented by Disney, and at least one of them was incontrovertibly a great idea, which was to settle the Katzenberg litigation for a relatively modest amount, vetoed by Eisner. Now, I'd have to be a psychologist to fully explain this, but I do think that Eisner felt threatened on some level by Ovitz, and on some level, maybe unconscious, he was out to prove who was the most powerful man in Hollywood, and it wasn't Ovitz.
But you'd think that any head of a corporation who'd made so many bad mistakes would have been endangered a lot earlier. They also had Hyperion Books, which turned out to be a disaster. They passed on the CSI franchise. They could have had that.
That's an astounding story.
He had problems with Johnny Depp, one of the biggest stars, when they were doing Pirates of the Caribbean. And yet he continued. Is it because the board was were his true golden retrievers?
That's an interesting way of putting it. I do think one of the most important themes in this book is the subject of corporate governance, which has gotten a lot of attention in the criminal context, like Enron and MCI. But I think those are, in a way, aberrational. Far more typical is the Disney board, which was brilliantly manipulated by Eisner for many years, which was lulled into complacency by years of success, but then should have been far more vigilant long before it was. By the time anyone on the board began to murmur a voice of dissent, Eisner would ruthlessly punish them and dispatch them and use them as an example to other board members to stifle any disagreement. So there was, in effect, no meaningful board oversight.
How aware is Eisner of all of this in himself? He says to you at one point something like, everyone has his dark side.
Yeah, I know. That comment haunted me for days. I was kind of going around thinking, gosh, do I have a dark side? Did everybody I know have a dark side? I just don't look at the world in those terms. He clearly does. How self-aware is he? I honestly cannot say that. I did ask a question towards the end of our interview, which I thought was very important. And I said, you know, Michael, I realize you've had an amazingly successful career, but is it worth it to you to have lost all these friendships? And we just weren't speaking the same language. He not only didn't answer it, I don't think he could answer it.
James B. Stewart's Disney War is published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much for being with us today.
As always, it's a pleasure.
We're devoting much of tomorrow's show to short fiction and children's literature. First, David Sedaris, who wants to share his passion for short stories, and he will be here with one of his favorite short story writers, Laurie Moore, plus a look into the art of writing for children with Mo Willems, whose books include Don't Let the Pigeon Drive the Bus and The Pigeon Finds a Hot Dog. That and lots more coming up tomorrow. I'm Leonard Lope, your host, and I hope you have a great 4th of July holiday. I'll see you again tomorrow.
WNYC is supported by Telemundo 47 and the River to River Festival, presenting Yo La Tengo and Stephen Malkmus and the Chicks, free today at 3:30 on the lawn of Battery Park. Details, rivertoriverNYC.com. WNYC gratefully acknowledges the backing of our corporate underwriters and would like to add your business to our diverse list of supporters. To become a WNYC underwriter, contact Executive Director Vincent Gardino at 212-669-3013.
Yeah, my name is Ruben Makarian. I'm from Russia. 10 years back, I came here. I didn't speak English at all. So I went in subway. I said, oh, my God, am I going to survive in this subway or what? But later on, I found it's very, very good subway and it's very convenient. I came here as a visitor, but looks like I stay here forever. This is my home. I like it. I love it. We're New York Public Radio, WNYC.